this is Danielle Fisher. Welcome to Melanoma Insights for Professionals, brought to you by Melanoma Institute Australia. Today's discussion focuses on the multidisciplinary management of squamous cell carcinoma and basal cell carcinoma, the most common non-melanoma skin cancers. We are fortunate to have several leading clinicians with us today from a range of disciplines to discuss this topic. Facilitating the discussion is Dr. Robert Rawson. Rob is a pathologist at MIA and Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. We also have Professor Angela Hong joining us today. Angela is a radiation oncologist at MIA and a clinical professor at the University of Sydney. Dr. Kerwin Shannon is also joining us for the discussion. Kerwin is a surgical oncologist and a head and neck surgeon at MIA and the Chris O'Brien Lifehouse. And joining us today via Zoom all the way from Portugal is Dr. Inês Silva. Inês is a medical oncologist and researcher at MIA and is currently doing a fellowship at Westmead Hospital. Welcome to you all, and thank you for being with us today to share with our listeners our latest understanding of managing SCC and BCC in a multidisciplinary setting. Rob, perhaps you could start by telling us a bit about what are SCCs and BCCs, the role that a pathologist plays in diagnosing them, and what their clinical and pathological features of concern are.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Danielle. It's great to be here to talk to you. So today we're not talking about melanomas. We're talking about lesions which are a lot more common. So squamous cell carcinomas and basal cell carcinomas, they're the most common malignancies that occur in humans. Actually, they take up more than all other malignancies combined. And in a place like Australia, where we get a lot more ultraviolet radiation and sun exposure, they take up more than four times the amount of all other malignancies combined. So they take up a huge amount of both my pathological practice, but also I'm sure my clinical colleagues' practice as well. So it's really important. I think we talk about these kind of lesions, which can cause significant problems. Often, as we do in this podcast, we sort of combine SCCs and BCCs into one entity. We split it away from melanoma. But they are actually separate entities, and I think it's important maybe at the start just to compare and contrast these lesions. They have similarities, but they also have significant differences which affect our patients. So first of all, basal cell carcinomas, BCCs, they're derived from the basal cells of the epidermis and also the hair follicle, while the squamous cell carcinomas, SCCs, are malignancies derived from epidermal keratinocytes, sort of the more superficial keratinocytes in the epidermis, and show differing degrees of differentiation, but sort of at least try to recapitulate those squamous cells on some degree. BCCs are more common, and by the time they sort of say an Australian gets to the age of 70, one in two Australians would have been diagnosed with a basal cell carcinoma. Interestingly, it's important to note, I think, that squamous cell carcinomas can arise from an in situ component, so a malignancy that hasn't broken through the basement membrane, while BCCs generally are carcinomas which don't have a in situ component that we recognise. From what causes these lesions, we know from extensive studies that ultraviolet radiation exposure to sunlight is the most important risk factor in development of both of these malignancies. And that is shown by a dominant UV signature we see in the mutational processes of these carcinomas. So when we talk about that, we're talking about a cytosine to thymine transition. But we also know there are other causes that come into play with both of these lesions. So immunosuppression plays a significant risk factor for both of these, more so with squamous cell carcinomas. They talk about sort of up to 50 to 80% increased risk of a SCC when someone's immunosuppressed. With SCCs, other causes such as chronic inflammation, importantly HPV infection, and occupational exposures, which can also cause basal cell carcinomas. And also in my other practice, I also do a lot with gynecological pathology as well. And so we do see BCCs in some protected sites. So there are obviously other things at play as well, apart from just ultraviolet radiation. Now, presentation, I don't obviously see these lesions clinically. I see them when they arrive in the laboratory. So maybe, Kerwin, you can briefly describe to me and all of us here what these things generally present like. They have a wide histological presentation, and I presume they have a very wide clinical presentation as well.
Well, that's true. Essentially, when people coming into the clinic, the stock standard question I ask is, you know, do you have any new lumps or bumps? And that's what people will notice, is a change in the skin. And for the more squamous lesions, they tend to be starting as sort of scaly, even, you know, erythematous patches that are very indistinct. And they then can grow into nodules in the skin, and they can ulcerate. And often it's the ulceration that people notice first. They see a scab that sort of falls off and then doesn't heal and then gets a bit larger. But they have a very wide appearance. I think, as you know, there are 20 or more varieties of basal cell carcinoma, and so the appearances are just as varied. But it's usually a nodule growing in the skin with ulceration, a thing that just doesn't heal.
Yeah, as you mentioned, yeah, there are. So the histological presentation, particularly of basal cell carcinomas, is very diverse. As you mentioned, there's more than 20 different subtypes that we recognise histologically, what they look like. All of them really at some degree show what we call basaloid cells, which are blue, quite hyperchromatic with minimal cytoplasm. And they're all arranged in some kind of nest formation. Importantly for us to help with our diagnosis, there's normally some stromal changes around these cells, which is a really important clue to help us differentiate these lesions from other malignancies. And as you describe, with all these subtypes, generally it is the subtype which probably goes some way to describe what the clinical presentation is. So the nodular type of basal cell carcinoma usually, I think, would present with a little pearly papule on the skin, while infiltrative or morphaic kind of BCC presents with like a scar-like appearance or something deeper down, maybe more ill-defined and difficult to demarcate where the lesion actually extends to. When we're talking about subtypes, I suppose that's a good point to bring up now, is that's one of the most important features when I report out my basal cell carcinomas, is try to actively identify the subtype, because we know that that is one of the most important features, which gives my clinical colleagues an idea of which carcinomas are more at risk of local recurrence. So we know that the BCCs with a morphaic or infiltrative and a micronodular appearance are more risk of local recurrence and aggressive behaviour, generally thought to be through their higher risk of perineural invasion. So that's an important feature that I definitely try to accurately communicate to my colleagues. With squamous cell carcinomas, as we mentioned, they show squamous differentiation. And so those that are better differentiated, like a keratoacanthoma or a verrucous carcinoma, really almost recapitulate what a normal epidermis looks like. So large pink cells, which is what the squamous cells look like. And that goes all the way through to more poorly differentiated squamous cell carcinomas, which really show no differentiation, no keratinization, and no intracellular bridges, which are the two particular areas of squamous differentiation that we look for. They just look like malignant cells, which are appearing in the dermis or the subcutis. And we have to often look very carefully for squamous differentiation elsewhere, or do immunohistochemical stains to prove that they are actually squamous in differentiation. Now, when it comes to differential diagnosis, both of SCCs and BCCs, one of the main differential diagnoses is adnexal tumours, so benign adnexal tumours or malignant adnexal tumours. And this is a particular problem with BCCs when adnexal tumours showing differentiation down the hair follicle pathway, particularly in smaller biopsies, that can become a particular problem. And we often decide on the side of caution and recommend a complete excision if it is a partial biopsy, because it can be almost impossible to tell that and make that distinction. Distinguishing between the two, a BCC versus a SCC, can be particularly difficult, particularly in the more poorly differentiated squamous cell carcinomas. And even sometimes we get frozen sections or very small and fragmented biopsies, and you might be surprised to know that a normal hair follicle can be particularly difficult to distinguish from a basal cell carcinoma. Particularly for more junior pathologists and pathologists in training, that is a particular trap to fall into, particularly if it's not sectioned very well. When it comes to squamous cell carcinomas, I suppose the main differential diagnoses are benign entities. So florid hyperplasia next to an ulcer can be incredibly difficult to distinguish from a squamous cell carcinoma. That's why the clinical context of the lesion, which our clinical colleagues hopefully tell us, is really important to make that diagnosis. And also other things such as endophytic warts or keratoses can mimic a well-differentiated squamous cell carcinoma. At the more poorly differentiated end of the spectrum, as I mentioned, they can show no squamous differentiation. So things like melanomas and sarcomas do enter the differential diagnosis. When it comes to risk factors, as I mentioned, basal cell carcinomas, the subtype is really important. Otherwise, the depth of invasion and presence or absence of perineural invasion are definitely things that I try to communicate in every biopsy that I diagnose and report. Well, squamous cell carcinomas, they have a definite staging system, and that's based on the diameter of the lesion, the invasive depth, and presence or absence of perineural invasion. My clinical colleagues might talk about more at-risk areas, such as the lip, maybe, or the ear, and also the extent of the perineural invasion and the width of the perineural invasion. So moving on. Kerwin. So many squamous cell carcinomas and basal cell carcinomas are managed out in general practice, where cryotherapy, curettage and cautery or topical treatments are used. However, obviously, sometimes surgery or more extensive treatment is needed. Kerwin, can you describe when a GP should refer a patient to see you and your colleagues, and what role does surgery play here?
Well, surgery obviously plays a very large role. I mean, you don't get your specimens until we cut them out, although there are ways other than large excisions to get them out. But, you know, as you said, they're very common. And if we saw every single squamous cell carcinoma and basal cell carcinoma that came through a GP's door, we'd be doing nothing else. But there are those tumours that are considered high risk, and there are those that are considered low risk, and those risk factors are both clinical and pathological. You've mentioned some of the pathological ones. The clinical ones, the location of the tumour is very important. Those that are on sort of broad flat areas like the trunk and the middle of the limbs can be generally dealt with quite easily locally. But when you've got lesions that are on the face, when you've got them on cosmetically sensitive areas like the lip and the ear and the nose, or even the hands, the soles of the feet, around the ankles and so forth, then it's important that someone who can handle those areas is actually doing the definitive treatment for them. And the size of the tumour is very important, and the size varies, you know, depending on those locations. So if you've got a large tumour on the trunk, then that's something that might need to be referred to a surgeon. If you've got a smaller lesion that's on the nose or even a tiny lesion on the ear, you wouldn't expect those to be being dealt with in GP's practice. The borders of the lesion are very important, and you will be aware there's pathological correlate there, but the more irregular the border, the less likely it is that a general practitioner is going to guarantee getting around it, and someone who's dealing with those in a specialist practice should look at them. Whether they're primary or recurrent is important. You know, if a GP's taken something out and it comes back, you know, repeating the same action, expecting a different outcome, there's a definition for that, and you know, we'd expect recurrent lesions to be referred on. You've mentioned the role of immunosuppression, and if you've got a patient with what seems like a relatively straightforward thing, but in a context of immunosuppression, those people are likely to be at high risk and we'd want to see them. And if they've been treated before, whether it's with curettage, as you've mentioned, or topical treatment, or even with surgery and it comes back, then you've got to think harder about it, and I'd refer those on. Then there are the pathological risk factors and the growth patterns you've mentioned. I won't go into that anymore. The presence of perineural invasion in the biopsy portends a, you know, a very poor behaviour, and we'd want to see those. And those sorts of risk factors are common in both squamous cell carcinoma and BCC. But in squamous cell carcinoma, we'd also be concerned about tumours that are growing quickly. So the growth rates are important. If they've got evidence of perineural invasion clinically, so numbness and tingling, particularly in the head and neck region, the thicker the tumours are, and if they've received a report from their partial biopsy which shows lymphovascular invasion or perineural invasion, then they really should be sent on.
Just from a pathologist's point of view, I'm interested to know, what kind of margin do you look for in these lesions? Does that change?
Well, it changes depending on whether it's BCC or SCC, and even in BCC it changes on what the growth pattern is. You know, the very common nodular cystic tumours, you can get a 2 or 3 millimetre margin around those and be very happy with them. If you've got a squamous cell carcinoma, you'd probably be, you know, starting at least 5, and if they've got a very infiltrated growth pattern, you'd be thinking about going even wider. So that's important. If, you know, you've got a high-risk tumour and a squamous cell carcinoma is cleared by 2 or 3 millimetres, and there's no other indication for you to do anything further, you might be happy watching that, but there would be cases, and again, depending on the patient factors, those risk factors that I mentioned, you might think about doing re-excision, particularly if you're addressing the lymph nodes, and I guess that's another issue we'll talk about.
And you mentioned sort of monitoring these patients. Do you get most of your patients back to have a look at them, or just the high-risk ones?
Usually just the high-risk ones, and it depends on who sent them in. You know, if they've got a person who's been regularly checking their skin, or they're associated with a dermatologist, we'll share the load. You know, if they've been sent as a once-off and they've got a high-risk tumour and I'm wanting to know what happens, then I'll follow them up myself. So it varies depending on their circumstances and their referral patterns.
And lastly, Kerwin, how is surgery used in combination with other treatment modalities that we have at our disposal?
Well, it's a changing field at the moment. Firstly, you know, radiotherapy is obviously something that can be used as an alternative to definitive treatment with surgery. It can be used as an adjuvant. And depending on how high risk the patients are, you know, we involve the other oncologists very frequently. Certainly in my context as a head and neck surgeon, see lots of advanced disease, particularly with nodal metastases, then we have the radiation oncologists involved very early. In terms of the primary lesions mentioned before, one of the high-risk features is cosmetically sensitive areas, and it may be particularly for BCCs that, you know, definitive treatment with radiotherapy can be used on the the nose and the ears and around the eyelids and those sorts of places. And there may be a role for topical treatments as well. Not so much with squamous cell carcinomas. The superficial lesions can be treated topically. But in most circumstances, radiotherapy would be used as an adjuvant in squamous cell carcinoma rather than as definitive treatment. But there are individual circumstances where that changes.
Yeah, it's important. I always drill into my pathology registrar, so it's really important to give an accurate estimation, maybe not as important as the depth in a melanoma for prognosis, but to give our clinical colleagues an idea of what they're dealing with, how deep these SCCs and BCCs go into it. So maybe it does open up the possibility of some topical treatment.
Certainly, I mean, the margins are very important, and you obviously lose pathological information if it's treated with non-surgical means. And so one of the things that might help the decision there is if salvage of a carcinoma in a particular area is still achievable regardless of the margins were originally, then you'd have a lower threshold for doing non-surgical treatments. But if you're concerned that, you know, if you've got it wrong and they recur and salvaging that will be difficult, then you'd be less likely to want to refer them on at that point.
Great. So we've spoken about our oncology colleagues. So moving across to firstly, Angela. Although there is a low mortality rate for non-melanoma skin cancers with 1.9 deaths per 100,000, there is a risk that complacency sort of develops amongst clinicians. As such, it's important to identify those patients who are at high risk of relapse and manage them appropriately with treatments which may include radiation therapy, both in the definitive setting and also as adjuvant therapy. Angela, when would radiation therapy be indicated for SCC and BCC?
As Kara mentioned, most of the BCC and SCC are managed by surgery. You cut it out, check the margin, then it's done. We do radiotherapy for very specific indications. So in a definitive setting, meaning using just radiotherapy alone without any other treatment, we use it, say, for a cosmetic sensitive area, so on the face, in a younger person, you worry about the cosmetic outcome or the functional outcome after local excision. For a small BCC, the cure rate with radiotherapy is very high, 90% plus. But it does take time to deliver, so it's not a one-off treatment. You often have to come in at least 4 to 6 weeks of daily treatment. But small lesion BCC, they do respond very well and generally have very cosmetic outcome in the longer term. And same for SCC. Perhaps for SCC, we'll be leaning more towards surgical excision if possible. But again, if it's in an area that we worry about the cosmetic outcome or patient not fit for surgery because of comorbidities, they're on a blood thinner, they can't tolerate a general anesthetic, then we will consider radiotherapy as definitive treatment. In the adjuvant setting, meaning adding in radiotherapy after local excision, really depends on the pathology. So I'll be asking the surgeon and pathology colleagues, is there a close margin or involved margin? Where is it in the specimen? Then I'll go back to the surgeon and ask them, is it possible to get a bigger margin or you've gone as far as you could and really couldn't get any more margin? Then in that setting, we'll consider adding in radiotherapy. Other indications for adjuvant radiotherapy would include those who already had surgery, recur, having a second operation. So those patients are at a high risk of getting the skin cancer coming back again. You mentioned perineural invasions. That is when the pathologist could see the nerve endings being affected by the cancer cell. That is another indication that the BCC or SCC could come back locally. Sometimes the coming back is not on the skin surface, it's under the scar. That is not easy to detect. So we, in that situation, whenever we see a perineural invasion, we assess the extent of the perineal invasion and then consider adding in radiotherapy at that time.
And I think you've sort of touched on it a little bit already, but is there a difference in how you'd approach an SCC and BCC in the way you'd give the radiation therapy?
Yeah, we do give slightly different margins in terms of a smaller margin. So usually for BCC, we add a 5 millimeter around the clinical lesion. For SCC, at least a centimeter, depending on the location, the anatomical location. And if someone have a perineal invasion, the margin will be even wider. Slightly different dose as well. We tell the patients often, depends on how often the patient can attend the radiotherapy department. If they're really old and frail, transport to a hospital is going to be difficult, then we can try to do it a bit quicker in 3 weeks. But if it's, say, a BCC on the nose, you really want to achieve a good cosmetic outcome, then I spread the radiotherapy out a bit more to 6 weeks daily treatment. You heal a bit better. You get a better cosmetic outcome.
You've talked about healing. So maybe you can talk us through the side effects. I hear you talking about this all the time, but
sure.
Probably differs on different parts of the body. But what are the general side effects?
Yeah, you're exactly right. So the radiotherapy side effects are local. So if you're treating a skin lesion on the arm, will be the skin within the treatment areas on your arm that start to go pink, usually about halfway through the course of radiotherapy. Peak at the end of the course of treatment, like a bad sunburn, itchy, might be peeling off, shouldn't have any bleeding, so could be uncomfortable. And the peak reaction time is at the end of the radiotherapy and generally will stay for another 10 to 14 days and then will start to heal. So that's the localized side effects. Most patients get a bit tired from the radiotherapy, and I think partly just coming in each day, keeping an appointment can make you tired. But generally, it's not associated with nausea and vomiting. Patients are not immunosuppressed, and most of these are done as an outpatient, and people can go to work and do their daily activities without problem at all.
The degree of the side effects, does that show you that actually the treatment's working, or is that an independent feature?
It's independent.
Independent of it's working.
Okay. Yeah, it's important to point out that with skin cancer radiotherapy, we're giving a full dose on the skin, so we expect the skin to go red. For example, if someone having radiotherapy to the lung, their chest wall will not be red because the target's not on the skin. Yeah. I'll be worried if the skin is not red.
Not reacting.
Yeah.
Thanks, Angela. And so obviously the big difference, I think, in these lesions is the risk of behaviour. We've spoken about how they both have risks of locally aggressive behaviour, but obviously the risk of metastatic disease is a lot higher in a squamous cell carcinoma compared to a basal cell carcinoma, where the risk is really just a local aggressive disease. I've seen about a handful of bona fide metastatic BCCs in my practice. Is that everyone else's experience?
Yes, they're not common by any stretch of the imagination. And when they do turn up, they're usually in the context of people that have had very long-standing, large, aggressive tumours, or in those people who have got very significant immunosuppression.
Let's turn our attention to medical oncologists and S. There are rare patients to whom surgery and or radiation therapy is insufficient for the treatment of advanced BCCs and SCCs. Can you talk us through how systemic therapy plays a role and how it has changed over the recent years?
Yes, sure. Thanks, Rob. So let's go back a little bit. So as you mentioned, definitely BCCs, they rarely metastasize. Cutaneous SCC, like up to 5% can metastasize. So systemic treatment has evolved like significantly in the last years for both types of cancer. And I have to separate them because even though they both have similar risk factors, and as you mentioned before, so the UV damage, immunosuppressant patients, in fact, the treatments that we have available, and I'm going to discuss a few things, they are different for both types of cutaneous cancers. So I'm going to start with cutaneous SCC. What we have, in fact, that showed significant improvement of the outcomes was cemiplimab. So cemiplimab is anti-PD-1, which is an immune checkpoint. So probably you all know, or you all have heard about pembrolizumab or nivolumab. So this is a very similar drug. So blocks PD-1. And with that, we can boost the immune system to fight against cancer. So that's the same concept. So we have basically two trials showing improvement of, or significant improvement of outcomes in terms of response rate and even progression-free survival for those patients. So this, just to explain, this drug is an intravenous drug, so it's given every 3 weeks. And the side effects are similar to what is known for the other anti-PD-1 agents like nivolumab or pembrolizumab. So because we are stimulating the immune system, we can create an autoimmune reaction in any organ. So in fact, any organ can be affected, and that's what we explain to the patients. But in reality, when we use anti-PD-1 monotherapy, we know that those side effects, the serious adverse events, are rare. But of course, we explain to the patient about skin toxicity with some rash or inflammation of the liver, with hepatitis, or of course, inflammation of the colon, colitis, sometimes can also affect the lungs and the kidneys. So that's for cutaneous SCC. So we have very good, so we have response rates that they go up to 58% with long-term responses. That's the good part of the cutaneous SCC. The thing is that we don't have the cemiplimab listed in the PBS. So we have an access program, and we have some clinical trials around Sydney and around the country where we can access easily this drug. So that's the standard right now. But I think it's important to also probably mention where we came from. So regarding cutaneous SCC and also for BCCs, we started with chemotherapy. And I think sometimes we forget completely about chemotherapy. So chemotherapies were basically based on platinum combinations. The response rates were not bad. They were about the same as we have for cemiplimab. But we had a lot of toxicities and the responses were short term. That's why we stopped that and we started cemiplimab. For cutaneous SCC, there are also some evidence that EGFR inhibitors like cetuximab can play a role here. But again, short-term responses. That's why right now the standard is cemiplimab, and we have a trial showing that and is well-tolerated. The side effects are similar to what we have seen for other anti-PD-1s with melanoma and other cancers, and that's the standard right now. But as Kerwin and as Angela mentioned, this, of course, to manage those patients, it's a multidisciplinary assessment of the patient management. So, of course, we have to consider radiotherapy and surgery when appropriate. Regarding BCC, and even though the risk factors are the same, we would expect that immunotherapy would work. And we have some evidence that it works. In Australia, we don't have that available on a PBS listing. So what we have is hedgehog inhibitors. So BCCs, they have the hedgehog pathway activated. So in fact, we have two inhibitors, the vismodegib and sonidegib, we have available. They are oral drugs, but the side effects are completely different. And I think that's very, very important to understand and to discuss with the patient, because sometimes it's hard for the patients to tolerate. So they are oral tablets taken every day, but the side effects are significant fatigue, loss of appetite, loss of weight, and also pain in the joints and cramps, so muscle spasms. And we don't have an effective treatment for those side effects. So it's really about how we can manage. Sometimes we have to give some break off the treatment. But that's true that this is the standard right now. And we have good response rates. And we also have long-term responses about 8 months. So which is a great achievement for those patients. When I mentioned that there's a big rationale for these patients also to respond to immunotherapy, in fact, we have recent data showing that another anti-PD-1 also showed good responses in those patients who failed hedgehog inhibitors. About one third of the patients would respond to anti-PD-1. So I suspect, so we don't have that available right now. We have in the context of clinical trials, which has an oncologist and someone passionate about all these topics. I think one big rule when we see a patient, when we have a patient with locally advanced and or metastatic disease, of course, we have to see what is available where we are, but in terms of PBS listing, but also which clinical trials are available, because specifically in the complex skin cancer field, like cutaneous SCC, but also basal cell carcinoma, there are very interesting trials ongoing. And specifically for basal cell carcinoma, where we don't have immunotherapy available, clinical trial can be an option.
Great. It's good to hear this. Really making large inroads into improved treatments in this area, which causes a significant burden to the health of many people in Australia. Just hearing all that, I suppose it's good at this point to notice that probably prevention is better than some of the treatments you offer. And so
that's true.
So wearing a big hat and a nice long shirt over summer in this country is particularly important.
Especially in Australia.
Yeah. So moving sort of to the group as a whole here, there are some special patient populations we need to consider in patients with this disease, such as people that have multiple SCCs and BCCs, or patients with immunosuppression. Just want to open up to the group about how people that might be in one of those two groups, how you might change your management, your prevention strategies for patients like this. Maybe you start with Kerwin.
That's an important question. One of the specialists missing from this roundtable discussion this morning is a dermatologist. And in my hands, if there were people with lots of squamous cell carcinomas and lots of basal cell carcinomas, I would certainly be calling for help. So even as a specialist, I would refer off to a specialist. Generally, my role would be to deal with the particular tumours that are at high risk or are particularly symptomatic, but they do need to have their entire skin regularly monitored. And there may be, you know, certainly topical treatments that might be required. The immunosuppressed patient group is obviously a very important one, and we see lots of people on transplant programs and people with hematological disorders and so forth. And they should all be having very regular monitoring so that lesions are picked up as early as possible.
Yeah, I know at RPA, I suppose with a big transplant population, they do have particular immunosuppression clinics, I think, in the dermatology team. So we get swathes of biopsies on one particular morning where must translate to that particular clinic that they have in dermatology. So it's
and in terms of the impact on the actual treatment, we tend to be less conservative with margins. We tend to have a higher threshold for involving the radiation oncologist, for example, and we think more significantly about chasing regional lymph nodes in that immunosuppressed patient group. We haven't spoken much about the lymph node metastases for squamous cell carcinoma, but it's obviously very important. And the sorts of tumours that would be referred on to someone like me are going to be those people that are high risk. Sentinel node biopsy has not got as well established role in non-melanoma skin cancers as it has in melanoma, but we're certainly finding roles for lymphatic mapping to help us plan the extent of surgery and to follow those people more closely who've got higher risk tumours.
Well, as Kerwin mentioned, those patients with a personal history of multiple SCC and BCC or those who are immunosuppressed, regular checkup by specialist dermatologists is very important. Skin surveillance, we want to find the lesion while they're small so it can be adequately treated by either surgery or radiotherapy. So that's very important. So for those patients who are immunosuppressed and we can't change the immunosuppression because of the heart transplant or kidney transplant, perhaps the indication for post-operative radiotherapy will be slightly broader. I'll have a lower threshold of recommending post-operative radiotherapy.
It's important. I think pathologists are always thinking, particularly when they see patients with multiple tumours of any kind, could there be a possible germline or genetic cause for this? And I suppose the most common one we talk about in BCCs is Gorlin syndrome or nevoid basal cell carcinoma syndrome. And so that's always important, I suppose, for clinicians to think about if they're starting to see multiple basal cell carcinomas, particularly in those of a younger age and numerous over the body. And they can have other systemic things such as particular cysts in the jaw or other skeletal abnormalities. So that's something that we sometimes make a note of if we start to see multiple. They might be seeing multiple conditions and it might not have put it all together. So that's part of our role, I think, as a pathologist to bring that to the attention of our clinical colleagues.
I'd just like to highlight a point that Inish mentioned before is the multidisciplinary team input management of this patient. So if someone have multiple lesions or we really start thinking about getting the medical oncologist involved, this type of patient really should be managed in a multidisciplinary team setting with input from everyone, pathology, radiology.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, the question that was asked to me initially was, you know, who should be sending them to me? When they're sending them to me, they're not sending them to me, they're sending them to my team. And these complex patients will be discussed around several roundtables.
Rob, I just want to add one thing regarding the immunosuppressive patients. So regarding our management, one thing that we try to understand, why are they immunosuppressed? Like, is it like a with medication? Is it a transplant patient? Is it a CLL? Because one thing is, can we reduce the immunosuppression? So if it's something that we can reduce, that would be our first step. Because one thing that we have is problematic in oncology right now is it safe to give immune checkpoint inhibitors, so immunotherapy for those patients? So that's a very, very common question. And it's starting to be more common for complex skin cancer once we use immune checkpoint inhibitors for that population. So we don't have much data in this population, but we have, in fact, some data from our group where they showed in a small group of, for example, transplant patients, where they saw that 2 out of 6 patients had rejection of the transplant, but 2 had response. So this is really a balance between risk and benefit. But for patients with hepatitis and HIV, it was no problem in terms of safety. And in fact, we saw some responses. This data is from melanoma. Of course, we cannot translate completely, but in terms of safety, we could use that data to probably treat those patients.
Great. And I suppose before we move on, particularly in these high-risk patients, once again, prevention strategies is really crucial, I think, to stop these people getting further malignancies if they're prone to get them. So it's good to get a great sort of outline of these lesions. So I think let's sort of bring it in and focus on a particular case. Let's look at how you would determine treatment modality for a particular patient. Now let's talk through a case study.
Very recently, I had a gentleman in his 80s referred to me with a rapidly growing nodule on his cheek and beginning to ulcerate out through the skin. And there was concern here that there didn't appear to be a precursor lesion initially. You know, is this actually nodal disease at the outset or is it a primary tumor? So he was referred into our head and neck service. We did some imaging for him, which suggested this tumor was eroding through to the surface of his parotid fascia. Couldn't see any evidence of regional lymph node metastases, but there are certain features about it that place him at higher risk, namely the large size. It was getting up to about 2 centimeters by the time I saw him. The fact that it was showing, you know, that it was infiltrating surrounding tissues. And so, you know, we were concerned about whether this had the potential to spread to lymph nodes. In this particular individual, because of where it was, to get a deep margin, to get a clear margin on this tumor, we were going to go into the salivary gland that's underneath there, and we know this salivary gland contains a number of the at-risk lymph nodes. So we was effectively getting an elective lymphadenectomy just to take the primary out. So his surgery was extended to include the at-risk lymph nodes, and we don't have time here to discuss how we make that decision. But here was an example of where we use lymphatic mapping. I had planned to take out a number of regional lymph nodes, but I was concerned that I didn't want to leave any behind that were at risk. So we actually did lymphatic mapping and discovered that there were 2 sentinel nodes that lay outside the area that I had planned to dissect. So as well as that dissection, I took out those additional sentinel nodes. As it happened, all of the nodes were negative. The tumour was cleared very well peripherally, but extended very close to the deep margin, which was in the plane of the facial nerve. We really couldn't go deeper than that without taking that nerve out. So we had a very high-risk primary with node negative. There was no perineural invasion. There was, in fact, no lymphovascular invasion, but a very aggressively behaving tumour. And I guess, Andrew, this is someone that you would think about offering radiotherapy to at the outset. I don't know what your view is on that.
Yeah, no, definitely. A fast-growing tumor with a very deep, close deep margin. And you made a point that it's going very close to the facial nerve. So any recurrence could be underneath and potentially can cause quite a lot of significant symptoms. So in that setting, I will consider adjuvant radiotherapy for this patient.
So we certainly considered it. But given that he was node negative and he didn't have those pathological features, we elected to observe it. But at his first follow-up, he, in fact, did have signs of recurrence, but it wasn't at the primary site. It was actually in the scar in the neck where we'd gone to get his lymph nodes out, those negative lymph nodes. And this might have been an incidental additional tumour, although the photographs that I took showed no sign of a tumour there. But the only other explanation I would have for this is implantation at the time of surgery from this very aggressive. So despite the fact that his primary site was controlled and those other risk factors weren't there, this is very bad behaviour. And so, again, now sent back to the radiation oncologist for yet a further discussion, and I think...
I know. So this is a no-brainer. Recurrent after the first, 3 months?
Three months.
So very short disease-free interval. I'll consider radiotherapy. In fact, strongly recommend radiotherapy to this patient to reduce the risk of local recurrence. And the radiotherapy field is going to be interesting. I'll be thinking about covering the primary site or your initial surgical bed. You'd be thinking this recurrence could represent an implantation.
And that was precisely the question I asked, that should the entire surgical bed be irradiated? And I think you've answered that question. Yes. And Anesh, my concept of the people that are eligible for consideration of adjuvant immunotherapy is anyone who's got disease bad enough to get radiotherapy is potentially eligible for trials. I'd be interested to see what your thoughts for additional adjuvant treatment after his radiotherapy.
Yes, again, so we don't have anything available outside the clinical trial for adjuvant setting, but the case you described in patients with a high risk of recurrence, they'll be eligible for, so someone high risk enough to have a therapy, they'll be eligible for an adjuvant trial in general concept. But of course, we have to see which trials are available at each site and at each time. Just to explain a little bit how the trials work. Once we have a drug that works beautifully in the metastatic or locally advanced setting, then we tend to move that drug to an early stage. That's where we are in cutaneous SCC. And I think with BCC, it will be the same. So we have to prove first with immunotherapy in the metastatic setting, and then later on we'll definitely move to earlier stages.
And so we've spoken about the options going forward, and how would you monitor this patient otherwise, Kerwin,
from my point of view, I'd be monitoring them clinically. If there was any evidence of further recurrence, I mean, you could think about doing systemic staging, particularly if it came to a point where it's requiring more aggressive surgery. At this point, he doesn't. In fact, the risk of systemic metastases and the absence of nodal metastases is actually relatively low in SCC, but certainly, you know, further adverse behaviour would be looking to stage him systemically. But I probably wouldn't at this point, although the other oncologist looking after him may think differently.
Now, I think that's a good point because we don't have a standardized way to follow up those patients. Like, we have the same problem with melanoma, even with more data. In these patients, even probably worse because we have limited data. But I think the problem that we feel is, like, if we have a patient on a clinical trial, we have a specific protocol. And sometimes we scan the patient every 12 weeks. So then when we see a patient being treated sometimes with the same drug, and if they are not being followed the same way, we feel a little bit, we don't feel it's right. So that's where we are right now. We have to generate more data so we can have a proper standardized way to follow up those patients.
So that's SCCs covered. So how about we discuss a case for basal cell carcinoma, Cohen?
Again, a very recent case. This one is a gentleman who referred to me at the age of 59 with a lesion on his nose. It had fairly classical appearances for BCC with rolled margins and telangiectasia, and he reported that it was oozing and there was incipient ulceration. But 10 years earlier, he'd actually had treatment at that site for basal cell carcinoma. He'd had Mohs micrographic surgery to ensure he had clear margins at that time, and he needed a local flap for repair. He wasn't a particularly high-risk patient. There were no immunosuppression or other comorbidities that were at risk. So, you know, at the outset, this appeared to be a relatively straightforward, well-defined lesion, and so we recommended surgical excision. That surgical excision showed extensive involvement of all of the margins that were taken
our
around.
Heart sort of something sinks sometimes when we see exactly. These excisions, and we have to tell the surgeons that they have to go back.
And so, I mean, again, no dermatologist present. There might be a role for further Mohs surgery, and this isn't the place to discuss the options. But we effectively did what we colloquially know as slow Mohs, where we actually did re-excise that area but not reconstruct it until we were happy we had clear margins. And he ended up with a defect that took out the side of his nose, including the nasal bone, and left his nasal cavity on view, and needed a very complex stage reconstruction over a number of months. And then some 18 months later, despite our clear margins by slow Mohs, he turns up with recurrence on the other side of his wound and has gone through a similar process. So I'm wondering, again, where the roles of additional treatments are here. Should he have had some radiotherapy at the outset? Is there a role for systemic therapy in a man with a tumour like this before embarking on surgery? One of the things about BCC is that if you try systemic therapy and it fails, they're going to end up with the same operation. You're not likely to lose an opportunity to do what you would have done the first time around.
Yeah, so after your first big resection, was there any perineural invasion? Or you mentioned the margins were all clear.
No, there was no perineural invasion. It was just really this morphic, highly infiltrative tumour extending well beyond what was clinically apparent.
But you got a clear margin at the end.
We got a clear, we believe we had a clear margin, but 18 months later we were shown we probably didn't.
General principle, someone with a clear margin, that we would not routinely add in radiotherapy, especially someone after a complex reconstruction.
And the issue here too, the timing of that reconstruction was over several months, you sort of lose a window to deliver adjuvant therapy, and somewhere like the nose, those reconstructions are compromised if you're doing them in a radiotherapy field.
So regarding systemic treatment, definitely there is a role. But I would just like to clarify how to address this patient. So question for you, Kerwin, before I answer your question. Is this patient completely unresectable, or would you consider further resection with the help of some systemic treatment?
It's certainly resectable, but the resection is essentially a partial or complete loss of the nose, which can be reconstructed, and there are all sorts of ways of putting that back together.
So the reason why I ask this question, so let me go back to the standard answer to this case. I would say that, yes, we have systemic treatment, and in fact, we have the hedgehog inhibitors. I'm talking about PBS-listed. We have the Vismodegib and the Sonidegib that I mentioned before, oral tablets. We have a response rate of about 45% in locally advanced situations, which is that one, which we have to consider cleared and resectable to be able to treat those patients, which I think we can claim this patient and resectable. Not that is not possible, but because of cosmetic reasons, I think it's that would be my answer, like easy answer. But I think for those cases and more, and apologies if I'm like probably pushing too much for clinical trials, but that's true that we have available clinical trials, not only in Sydney, but in around the country that we can also consider, not only for locally advanced or metastatic. This is not the case for metastatic, it's for locally advanced, but sometimes also for in the neoadjuvant setting. Sometimes we have options where we treat before to make the surgery a little bit easier. Of course, when we talk about neoadjuvant, we always think about involvement of the lymph nodes, but are some clinical trials more for just local disease. So my answer will be yes, and I'll definitely treat with systemic treatment. I'll give a hedgehog inhibitor, either sonidegib or vismodegib. The side effects are very similar. Response rates are very similar. But I think for every single patient, we should check which trials we have available and if the patient is a trial candidate or if there's any benefit for the patient to consider a trial.
Fantastic. Well, I think we've had a great discussion today on these really common lesions that we see in our population.
Yeah.
And I hope you've got something out of it. We've talked, I think, about the pathology. So I looked at the etiology, the microscopic appearance, the macroscopic appearance, the at-risk features. What features that people who are managing these patients in the community might wish to refer to a specialist surgical oncologist, and the features which the oncologist look for to manage these high-risk patients. So I hope you got something out of it, and thank you for listening.
Thank you, Rob, Inesh, Angela and Kerwin for sharing your expertise with us today. You have been listening to Melanoma Insights for Professionals, brought to you by Melanoma Institute Australia and made possible through unrestricted educational grants from Pierre Fabre, Bristol Myers Squibb, Novartis and Merck Sharp and Dohme Pharmaceuticals. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please share it with a colleague or friend and be sure to leave us a review. For more practice-changing education, sign up to our Melanoma Education portal at melanomaeducation.org.au. Thanks for listening.